Greetings once again, America. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news. Stand by now for the World View. That's right, it is the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back to the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought. So good to have you with us for another week. And I want to start by mentioning my odd reference last week to the weather. I don't talk about the weather very often because, well, it's just the weather. You know, I've been reading the Bible. That's right. Don't be afraid. I've been reading the Bible, and I've noticed that the Bible rarely mentions the weather, except when it's extremely important. You know, Noah's flood and various droughts, famines, and things like that. But the weather doesn't seem to be a high priority in God's economy. But it's just funny. Last week, I mentioned the fact that spring has finally sprung, and now here in Denver, if you've looked at some of the headlines across the country, you realize that we've been stricken by yet even more climate change, as yesterday it was 80 degrees and we were out flying kites, and today we're clearing snow off the driveway. Interesting times indeed. Could it be that this is anthropogenic, this climate change here in Denver? And if so, I'd like someone to do something about it, because I don't appreciate the snow on the driveway. All that aside, that's just the weather. I want to thank Newt Gingrich for graciously ending his political career on Fox News last Sunday, when he was asked by the host about the possible hypocrisy of Newt leading the charge to impeach Bubba Bill Jeff Clinton, while Newt himself was carrying on an illicit affair and his wife was, stricken with cancer. Any hypocrisy there, Newt? And Newt, if this is the way you're going to handle this question, please just pack it in and head back to the university. Because, well, Newt basically said, look, I cheated, but I never lied. Under oath. I never lied under oath. Like Bill Clinton did. Yeah, that's what he said with a straight face on Fox News Sunday last week. And we want to thank Newt for bowing out early of the presidential race, because we never really appreciated him as a candidate in the first place. So goodbye, Newt Gingrich. Well, I hope that's the case. I hope that American politics haven't degenerated to the point where, well, we would accept this degenerate as a candidate for any high office, let alone the President of the United States. All right, now, let's get on to the big news of the week. I mean, the big news this week was that America is celebrating opening day. That's right, it's baseball season again. And opening day happened all over the country this week in parks and stadia, from sea to shining sea. So I want to start with a baseball story for all you sports fans out there. From Benbrook, Texas, two teenagers kicked off their Texas high school's baseball season by apparently sacrificing chickens on the field of play. The claim is that these two, 15 and 16-year-old Texas high school baseball players apparently decapitated baby chicks on a baseball field during spring break. Police have confirmed that the players were, quote, engaged in acts that caused the death of two baby chickens. It appears that superstition relating to a slump in baseball performance could have played a part, unquote. So notice that the police aren't going to say they killed the chickens, but they did engage in acts that caused the death of two baby chickens. I wonder if this police spokesperson spent any time at the Columbia School for Journalism. Well, they engaged in acts that caused the death of two baby chickens, instead of just saying they killed chicks, which is three words, and it would have It would have transmitted the facts of the story to the audience. But no. Let's see. The animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, also known as PETA, urged the school administrators to establish an animal rights club on campus and offered to help molest students. I'm sorry, offered to help educate students, did PETA, in the wake of this horrible tragedy. Why did I say molest? We'll get to that later. I have another PETA story, I do believe, that we'll get into later, and then you'll understand why I mistook educate for molest. All right, now, let's move on into the science, really, file, the health subfile. From Washington, D.C., an Associated Press story. At a two-day meeting last week, an FDA advisory committee examined whether available data links food dyes and hyperactivity in children. That's right. The panel was supposed to come out with some recommendations as to whether or not the agency should further regulate food dyes and do more studies on the issue or require better labeling of the additives. The FDA has said there is no proven relationship between food dyes and hyperactivity in most children, but the agency said that, quote, for certain susceptible children, unquote, hyperactivity and other behavioral problems may be exacerbated by food dyes and other substances in food. Yes, I know, be afraid, very afraid of those Cocoa Puffs. The FDA is holding... The FDA held the meeting in response to a 2008 petition filed by the advocacy group Center for Science and the Public Interest to ban yellow dye number 5, red dye number 40, and 6 other food dyes that may or may not be associated with hyperactivity in children. Michael Jacobson, the director of said Center for Science and the Public Interest, said at the meeting, that the only reason that the dyes exist in food is to trick consumers. Yes, he says, quote, dyes are often used to make junk food more attractive to young children or to simulate the presence of a healthful fruit or other natural ingredients. Jacobson says that dyes would not be missed in the food supply except by the dye manufacturers, to which I say to Mr. Jacobson, don't the dye manufacturers need to make a living as well? I mean, their children need to eat junk food too. What do you have against the dye manufacturers? And also, for all of you out there who are looking for some reason that your kids are out of control, it's more than likely a result of your poor child-rearing skills. Your failure to train and discipline your children is far more responsible than any food dyes or other environmental contaminants that you may be looking for. I would recommend that you raise your children appropriately in the fear and admonition of the Lord, and for heaven's sakes, keep them out of the public schools. That could lead to hyperactivity. Isn't it weird that everybody's looking for something outside of themselves to explain all the problems in their lives? You know, it's food dyes for hyperactivity, and back in Rome... Yeah, have you heard this, that the Roman Empire, it didn't really fall because they became completely decadent and homosexual and freaks. It was because they had lead pipes and it probably poisoned the water supply and all like that. Yeah. Anyway, I have a feeling that, well, I've found in my life that almost all the problems I've encountered are directly related back, data links me to those problems and the choices I make. And you'll probably find the same thing if you'll look at your life rationally and objectively. So do that. And forget about FD&C yellow number 5. It's probably not freaking your kid out. Now, on the same note from the politics file, I've got a story about U.S. government microwave mind control tests. Yes, Judith Scheindlin, who is a judge on television. She goes by the moniker Judge Judy. She was taken to a hospital last Wednesday after she began speaking a nonsensical string of words during a live recording of her courtroom TV show. And apparently, there's been a number of incidents like this, raising suspicions that government microwave mind control may be responsible. You remember Serene Branson, a Los Angeles reporter for CBS. She delivered a completely incoherent piece to the camera on the Grammy Awards last month. Do you remember that? You remember seeing that on the Grammy Awards?
No.
You didn't watch the Grammy Awards? Okay. Neither did I, but I'm going to trust the source here. This is from the Daily Mail out of London. So a CBS reporter goes incoherent on camera. Let's see, a Canadian news reporter whose report on the military campaign in Libya suddenly collapsed into gibberish is the third noted case in this string of high-profile media personnel lapsing into incoherent gibberish on the air. Was there another one? Yes. Sarah Carlson of WISC-TV in Wisconsin was reporting on Wisconsin's challenge to Barack Obama's health care reforms, but it soon became apparent that she was having trouble forming words, and the camera switched to her startled co-presenter. Well, this, folks, this spate of television presenters dissolving into on-air gibberish has sparked claims that the U.S. military could be to blame. That's right. A popular theory being circulated online blames the U.S. military's supposed research into using microwaves as a mind control weapon. Yes. Now, the article does note that America has never admitted to conducting research, but proponents say the effects produced by microwave signals stimulating the brain with fake images and voices exactly mimic those displayed in recent on-air breakdowns. Now, the Daily Mail does note that as to why the Pentagon might be targeting U.S. television presenters, the microwave theorists are far less clear. So, again, the professionals in the news media have a tendency to lapse into gibberish and incoherent statements. But let's not blame the odd concoction of prescription drugs that 90% of these people are on. Let's not blame the culture at large, which produces incoherency and gibberish all the time. Let's look for microwaves. And if there are no microwaves, perhaps there's aliens. And if there are no aliens, perhaps it's the Christians. Or, of course, it's probably the Jews. That's the most likely explanation for this wave of incoherency. But if you've lapsed into incoherency recently and uttered gibberish and you're just not feeling that good about yourself, let me give you a story that will at least let you feel a little bit better about your own particular pathetic lot in life. From Bel Air, Ohio, from WTRF-TV there, police have said a Bel Air man had to be removed from his home last Sunday. Police said the man's skin had become attached to the fabric of the chair after he sat in it for over 2 years. His skin was fused to his recliner. Authorities said he was sitting in his own feces and urine, and maggots were visible. Yeah. The interesting part of this story is that two other able-bodied people lived there. Another man who had a separate bedroom, and the girlfriend of the man whose skin was fused to his Barca lounger. Officials say the girlfriend served food to the man since he never got up out of the chair.
What's wrong with her?
That's it. If you're looking around for reasons that your life is miserable, it's either you or it could be the people really close to you who are enabling you. This fellow was apparently just wasting his life sitting in a Barca lounger and like that. One police officer said it was the worst thing he'd ever responded to. When I read that, I thought, really? I mean, don't police officers respond to horrific car accidents and domestic violence cases? And this is the worst thing this guy's ever seen? Maybe he was new to the force. The landlord, who the man was renting from, said that the man in the chair rented from her before and that he used to be an active and vital person. But now he's, well, apparently now he's not fused to the chair. I don't know if they took the chair out with him. I'm not sure of all the mechanics of how this all worked out. But anyway, the WTRF tells us that the 43-year-old man is currently in the hospital. No word on whether the Barca Lounger is there with him or if it may be a lazy boy. But what piqued my interest about this story is this fella is 43 years old, and I'm turning 43 years old this month. And I was feeling real good about having outlived Elvis, and now I see that this is a potential outcome, and I just don't know if it's worth going on.
Hey, I get you a chair for your birthday.
Please, don't get me a lazy boy for my birthday. That's the last thing I need. A lazy boy and a microwave. Forget about it. There's no point in going on. All right, now, another bizarre story that I heard this week, making me aware of something that I was not aware of. This is from Aurora, Colorado. University campus police and a construction firm are investigating how a woman got into a construction site, climbed a tower crane unnoticed, and then jumped to her death last Friday. The woman fell from the 150-foot-tall tower crane at the University of Colorado, Denver, Anschutz campus at about 7 o'clock in the morning in an apparent suicide. Now, for me, this is the first time I'd ever heard of a person jumping off a tower crane to their death. Have you ever heard of that? Okay, well, listen to this. A spokesman for the construction company says that there are no specific security requirements for tower cranes, which he said can be a magnet for people looking for a place to jump. He said, quote, "It's actually more common than you might think. People want to make a spectacular ending to, you know, like the boyfriend who jilted her, she wanted him to know, and so she does a high-profile swan dive off of a tower crane there at the construction site on the university campus. And here we are just a couple days later, and for all of the circumstance and all of the news media coverage, no one can even remember her name. Worldview, all the conservative talk you can handle right here with your humble host, Doug McBurney. Speaking of gibberish and incoherency, perhaps somebody had a microwave running in the studio the day that track was recorded. I can't understand a word that guy says. Okay. Got my head spinning around. That's all I can figure out. And I think I heard one baby in there. Heard him say baby, but hey, Chris, turn off the microwave the next time you get into the studio.
Think he did.
It's obviously having some kind of effect. All right. Now, oh, by the way, on that last story, if you want to have a spectacular legacy to your life, don't plan a suicide that's spectacular. Live a valuable life. And people will remember. If you just kill yourself, nobody's going to take you that seriously. And nobody's really going to remember. And nobody's really going to care. A life well lived is what it's all about. Not a spectacular end. Because no matter how spectacular and attention worthy you think your life is, chances are it's not that attention worthy unless you've spent your life doing something good, doing something important. So the next time you think you just want to sidle back in your Barca Lounger and just take it easy, remember that it's a life well spent that will cause people to actually remember you. All right, for whatever that's worth. All right, now, and speaking of that, a life well lived, let's go to the personhood file. This is from personhoodalabama.com. The Foundation for Moral Law and Personhood Alabama have announced personhood bills and amendments in the House and the Senate, backed by a large number of supporters. SB 301 states, quote, "The term persons, as used in the Code of Alabama, shall include any human being from the moment of fertilization or the functional equivalent thereof." The bill states, quote, "We must protect all Alabama children. At the same time, we have to send a message that Alabamians value the sanctity of life. Every heartbeat is as important as the next," said Senator Phil Williams, who introduced and is sponsoring the bill. He introduced that bill last Tuesday. And then over in the House in Alabama, HB 405 and 409 were filed by Representative John Merrill, a personhood statute and a personhood amendment, respectively, just for good measure. In case he can't get the amendment through, he'll get the statute through. If he can't get the statute through, we'll take the amendment. Praise the Lord. All right. Ben Dupree, an attorney with the Foundation for Moral Law, said, quote, "America used to define the meaning of person along racial lines. Now we draw that line at the womb. Personhood legislation finally gives equal protection of the laws to the unborn as well as everyone else like you and me, and from the first moment of human life." So here's two fellas who will be remembered, ladies and gentlemen, for a life well lived and a fight well fought. And we sure do appreciate their efforts in the face of all the abortion regulations that are being proffered this political season by those who would regulate the murder of innocent people. I just have one question. You know that popular wristband, "What Would Jesus Do?" Well, this isn't quite as pithy and concise as that. But my question to anyone out there who considers themselves pro-life, my question would be, how would Jesus prefer to regulate the killing of innocent children? Ask yourself that question. How would Jesus regulate? All right, now, I wanted to give you that personhood story just in case you were losing all hope. Before we get into the war file, and the war file, well, it's thick this week. There's all kinds of stuff going on. I want to start out with a little bit of good news. An Israeli military spokesman said last Friday that an aircraft had fired at a squad of the terror group Hamas that was planning to carry out kidnappings. She said the group was plotting the attacks for the Jewish festival of Passover. Later this month, a Gaza Health Ministry spokesman said three terrorists were killed. So that's the good news from the war front this week. And, well, I'll warn you that it's pretty much all downhill from there. Let's go to Iraq. Baghdad. Gunmen wearing military uniforms over explosive belts charged into a government building in Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit last Tuesday in an attack that left 56 people dead, including 15 hostages who were shot execution style. A five-hour standoff in Tikrit ended only when the attackers blew themselves up. The assault, according to the AP, was reminiscent of the bloodshed that was common during the worst days of the Iraq conflict. Iraq officials blame Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Al-Qaeda hostage raids last fall on a Catholic church in Baghdad left 68 dead and stunned the nation. And, folks, the nation of Iraq is hard to stun, but these terrorists are able to do it. One footnote, U.S. troops plan to leave Iraq at the end of this year. And, you know, I'm all for the troops coming home from Iraq, but I wish we'd left the place in better order. But I suppose without the moral superiority that America had garnered over the centuries, that having been squandered by the past generation or two of political and military leaders, I guess that we shouldn't have expected any better, that
Iraq will probably devolve into some state of chaos and bloodshed for many years to come, and we will have not left it much better than we found it, if any better at all. And that's just sad. Oh, and by the way, I'll get to Libya. Okay, well, let's just go to Libya, since it's the next story here. We've got Misrata in Libya. This is from WorldNet Daily. Misrata is the last big rebel stronghold in western Libya, but after weeks of shelling and encirclement, Gaddafi's forces appear to be gradually loosening the rebels' hold on the city, despite the western airstrikes that we've all been hearing and reading about over the past few weeks. According to WorldNet Daily, people in Misrata have expressed frustration at Western governments, which have assured their war-weary public that they will not be drawn into putting troops on the ground in Libya, and that they're just not going to do any more than the targeted kinetic military activities that are occurring right now. No boots on the ground. That's the pledge. The one thing America, two things America has pledged to do is, one, we will not lead. Two, we will not put boots on the ground. And I read an article earlier in the week that a couple thousand Marines had left Camp Lejeune and were on a boat off the coast of Libya. And I'm here to tell you, folks, that if Barry Ho breaks my Marine Corps in Tripoli, you've heard the Marine Corps hymn, "From the Halls of Montezuma to the Shores of Tripoli." The United States Marine Corps built, at least initially, their reputation in Tripoli, fighting off Islamic pirates back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. And the last thing I want to see is Barry Ho return the Marine Corps to Tripoli, especially if he were to throw a couple thousand Marines in there. And don't get me wrong, it's not that I don't think a couple thousand Marines could take, well, just about anything in Libya, or, well, just about anything anywhere. I would just hate to see my Marine Corps thrown into Libya without the support that they need. And if there's anyone capable of breaking the United States Marine Corps, it's Barack Hussein Obama, affectionately known here as Barry Ho. Yes, Barry Ho. We feel that that moniker encompasses all of Barry's ethnic diversity. His Hawaiian-ness, his blackness, and his whiteness. All in two little words. All right. So, anyway, I got my eye on you, Barry. Don't be breaking my Marine Corps. I take that personally. I would hold you personally responsible. All right. More from Libya, from Darna, Libya. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Two former Afghan mujahideen and a six-year detainee from Guantanamo Bay are training new recruits for the rebels for the front in Libya. The Wall Street Journal says the presence of Islamists like these has raised concerns that the goal of some Libyan fighters in battling Colonel Gaddafi is actually to propagate Islamist extremism. Gee, you think that's a possibility? Well, listen to this. Abdel Hakim al-Hassadi and Sufyan Ben Kumu were picked up by Pakistani authorities after the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan back in 2001 and were quickly turned over to the U.S. and apparently took part in the terrorist catch-and-release program, because one was released in just a couple of months, but the other spent 6 years in Guantanamo Bay. So they were imprisoned and released, and I'm sure they bear no ill will toward the United States, especially that fella who was in Gitmo for 6 years. Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, these Islamic leaders are known as, basically war heroes. Yeah, they have a reputation for discipline, and their fighting experience is badly needed by the Libyan rebels' ragtag army. Now, among his followers, Mr. Hassedi has the reputation of a trained warrior, and apparently his discourse has become dramatically more pro-American now that he stands in alliance with the West against Colonel Gaddafi. Mr. Hassadi, and which one was he? Now, was he the one who ended up in... I can't tell which was which. Anyway, he's an Islamist, But he's now aligned with us against Gaddafi. Allied with us, I should say. And he says, our view is starting to change of the U.S. If we hated America 100%, today it is less than 50%. That's right, 50%. And of course it will go back to 100% should we gain any power in Libya. But we really appreciate your airstrikes. And we really appreciate your Tomahawk missiles. And we really wish you would send us some Marines. Because this Gaddafi, he's very tough. Anyway, I've always said this whenever it's been asked, which is rarely, but it's very difficult to win a war without boots on the ground. So somebody's boots are going to end up on the ground there. And, well, I would prefer that it was not jump boots or jungle boots, no American boots. I'm all for sending in the French boots. Okay, John, put away that sousaphone. Put away that sousaphone. Yeah. Well, the French, you know, they've been a laughing stock for so long. It's about time that we give them an opportunity to lead. And besides, they're the ones who have all the oil deals with Libya, if I'm not mistaken. Them and our cousins, the Brits. Let them do what needs to be done. And, well, I'll stand up and salute, okay? All right, more from the, well, this is from the politics file, but it relates to the war. This is from, let's see here, well, it's from a local news, ChicagoBreakingNews.com. I'm not sure who this is, but I think it's a fairly reliable source. It's certainly as reliable as the AP or the Wall Street Journal. Here's the story, folks. Speaking from the pulpit of Chicago's Mosque Mariam, the Nation of Islam's international headquarters, which, by the way, was purchased 40 years ago with a $3 million loan from Muammar Gaddafi, Louis Farrakhan blamed demons, I say, for altering President Barack Obama's moral conscience and driving the assault on Muammar Gaddafi, who who Farrakhan calls his brother. And I don't know if that's in the religious sense or the black sense, but he calls him his brother. And he says it's demons, I say, that have altered Mr. Obama's moral conscience. Actually, I'm not so sure I'd say it was demons, Mr. Farrakhan. I'd look at perhaps Hillary Clinton and her likely replacement, Samantha Power, although the demon analogy does work on that level. Mr. Gaddafi. See, even me and Brother Gaddafi can... I'm sorry, did I say Brother Gaddafi? Yeah. I meant Brother Farrakhan. Even me and Brother Farrakhan can agree on some things that there are demons involved. Anyway, Gaddafi... I don't know why I keep transposing Gaddafi and Farrakhan. I think it's all the H's and the K's and the A's. It just confuses me. Anyway, Farrakhan said, quote, it is a terrible thing for me to hear my brother call these ugly and filthy names. Even though the current tide is moving against him, how can I refuse to raise my voice in Muammar Gaddafi's defense? Why would I back down from those like he who has given so much? Uh-huh. Yeah. He also said, quote, a major earthquake is on the way to you and to me and to us. Death and destruction is at the door of all of us. And we are less prepared than the Japanese. Unquote. He then commended former White House correspondent Helen Thomas for her honesty and candor in recent remarks about Israel and the Palestinians. So me and Mr. Farrakhan don't agree on all counts. You remember Helen Thomas saying that the Jews should go back to Poland and all the other countries where there were concentration camps, all of that. So anyway, Mr. Farrakhan, hey, the thing about Louis Farrakhan is at least you know where the guy is coming from. And one thing I appreciate in a competition or even a fight is knowing exactly where my enemy comes from. That's why I don't like Hillary Clinton, and I don't like Samantha Power, and I don't like the people who've surrounded Barry Ho. And by the way, I had a debate with my good friend and my brother, Bob Enyart, last week about whether or not Barry Ho... I posited my theory that Barry is basically on a suicide mission to destroy the country. A political suicide mission, not literal. He's not climbing a tower crane or anything like that. But a political suicide mission. He doesn't care if it ruins his political career as long as he destroys the country. And Bob said, you know, I disagree. I think he's more into going on vacation, playing golf, flying in Air Force One, and you know, being the president and enjoying all the perks of office. And really, he's about power and money. And I agree and I disagree. I maybe more disagree. I think what better way for someone to acquire power and money and enjoy the perks of office than to create chaos for the masses and to be the, to be the apparent political salvation of those poor masses as they struggle through the pressures that are being exerted by the political and cultural realities that are being instituted by the very guy who wants the power and the money. So anyway, me and my brother, Bob, we agree on many things, but not 100% on everything. I think it's a political suicide mission. And I think Barry Ho has ambitions far outside the United States. I think he's more interested in what the Third World thinks of him, since he plans to reign there somehow. I don't know. All right, now, let's go to another war of Barry's making in Ivory Coast. That is where I don't want to call Gbagbo a Christian, but he says he's a Christian. And the fella he ran against, Mr. Alassane Ouattara, is definitely a Muslim. So we have a nominal Christian and a nominal Muslim there was a presidential election in Ivory Coast. And the Muslim won, at which point the Christian said, well, this is insane. I'm not going to let the Muslims win. He set up his army and he said, this is it. I'll fight to the death. And here's what's happened. Over there in Ivory Coast, the Christians have been under siege. Gbagbo's army chiefs have abandoned him. And he's basically making his last stand. And it may be over as we go to air today. The Muslims may have overrun Gbagbo and the Christians there in Ivory Coast. But here's what's happened. Charity workers, this according to the Telegraph in London, charity workers said there apparently was a mass killing that took place on a single day. They found over 1,000 bodies in Dikui, Ivory Coast, and the bodies were found shortly after the town fell to troops loyal to Alassane Ouattara, the Muslim who's been internationally recognized as having won last year's presidential election. By the way, I had to insert the word Muslim there because nowhere in the story does the reporter point out that this is a conflict between Muslims and Christians. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure that the politics in Ivory Coast are more complex than merely Muslims versus Christians. But it definitely is a battle between Muslims and Christians, at least foremost in my mind, because be honest with you, I'm not familiar with the on-the-ground street view of politics in Ivory Coast. But now that the Muslims have overrun the town of Dikui, well, they found the bodies of 1,000 civilians massacred, and the article says the apparent massacre came despite the presence of United Nations troops. About 40,000 people sought refuge in a Catholic mission compound. The priests who operated are running short of food, clean water, medical equipment. and they're trying to treat people who've arrived with gunshot wounds and other wounds. The bodies of the 1,000 bodies are thought to be bodies of those who did not reach the Catholic mission in time. There were 200 United Nations troops operating what it said were robust patrols from its base on the outskirts to molest civilians and, oh, I'm sorry, to protect civilians in and around the church. Yeah, okay. So here you got a couple of hundred un-warriors trying to enforce a peace in Ivory Coast, and basically to install a Muslim leader. And since the goal is to install a Muslim leader, the un-troops apparently figured out the easiest way to do that was to allow the Muslims to slaughter the Christians, and they will achieve the goal of Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, the United Nations, and Ban Ki-moon, and all of the freaks who are hell-bent on a suicide mission to destroy civilization, at least in my humble opinion. I just don't understand it. I mean, what else could it be? What else could it be but a suicide mission? All right. Now, more from the war file. From the Associated Press, Kandahar, Afghanistan. I'm sorry, this is from Reuters. At least 10 people have been killed and 83 wounded in the southern Afghan city of Kandahar during violent protests over the burning of a Quran by a fundamentalist Christian in Florida. Yeah. A suicide attack also hit a NATO military base and killed 7 foreign staff. Protesters in Kandahar carried white Taliban flags and shouted some of their favorite mantras, including "Long live the Taliban" and "Death to America." They smashed shops and burned tires and vandalized a girl's high school. The attacks were allegedly driven by anger at the actions of extremist Christian preacher Terry Jones, who supervised the burning of a Quran in front of about 50 people at his small church in Florida back on March 20th. Now, I inserted the word allegedly, and I usually don't do that. I usually cross out the word allegedly when I'm reading stories from the Justice File. But here, the folks at Reuters apparently believe that all of this violence is related to this preacher, who they call an extremist, who burned his Quran in Florida. You remember, he threatened to burn the Quran, and then there was an international outcry, and then he backed off from burning the Quran. And then when all the cameras were off, well, he decided to burn the Quran anyway. Maybe they had a potluck planned, and you know how it is with church schedules. You do what you got to do, you know, to bring the people in so they can hear the gospel. If they want to see a Quran burned, well, you know, give the people what they want. Bring some potato salad. They probably had a great time. Anyway, the burning of the Quran initially passed relatively unnoticed in Afghanistan, but then President Hamid Karzai brought it up. And there were also calls for justice during Friday's sermons, and then thousands of people poured into the streets in several cities to denounce the Christians burning the Quran. So who's responsible for the violence? I'd say it's Hamid Karzai and the Muslim clerics who called for justice. I mean, all this guy in Florida did was burn a book, for crying out loud. I know that it's your holiest of holy... It's not like the third holiest book. It's not the fifth holiest book. The Quran is like the number one holy book to these pagans. But that doesn't justify looting shops, burning tires, and vandalizing a girl's high school. It seems to me that this fella in Florida could have burned the Quran and nobody would have even noticed if they didn't want violence and chaos. Because violence and chaos is the best way to acquire power and money when people are scared. And so I don't blame the preacher. Although there's a car dealer in South Brunswick, New Jersey, who apparently does. Listen to this from the AP. A New Jersey car dealer who offered a free car to the Florida pastor if he promised not to burn the Quran says he never thought the pastor would do it, and now he wants his car back. Well, Pastor Jones visited New Jersey back in October and collected a brand new Hyundai Accent, but immediately turned it over to a charity that helps battered women. So he's saying, look, I burned the Quran, but I don't have the car anymore. I gave it to this battered women's shelter. Well, the car dealer is ex-New York Giants tackle Brad Benson, and that's the fellow who offered Jones the car, and he's very upset. He now calls the Koran burning deplorable, and he says Jones should be held criminally liable for the deaths that have occurred in Afghanistan and other places around the Middle East. Well, I mean, he's a football player, Mr. Brad Benson, so we can't expect him to be all that bright or to be able to figure out that it wasn't Mr. Jones who incited the violence in Afghanistan. It was the politicians and the Muslim clerics. And the blood is on their hands, as it has been from time immemorial. Anyway, I appreciate Mr. Jones going ahead with the Koran burning, I suppose. I was against the Koran burning initially, but then I realized it was because I was being cowed and I was afraid. I was thinking, well, don't burn the Koran, you'll make the Muslims mad, and then they'll loot and riot and burn and decapitate and rape and pillage. And, well, that's not the attitude to have. You shouldn't take away someone's free speech right just because you're afraid of what it might trigger. Especially when it's the enemies of the man burning the Koran who want the violence and the bloodshed.
I bear lots of animosity to bellhops. They never bring my luggage up on time. And taxi drivers really tax my patience. If they vanished, would it really be a crime? I don't like meat and maids or underwater welders, health fanatic cooks or camera crews. Not fond of monks or yoga teachers or sports fans in the bleachers. And I'm not sure how I'm feeling about you. There are lots of horrid people on this planet that I
It is the Weekly World View. I am your host, Doug McBurney. We are rounding third and heading for home. And we're going to go, well, we got more from the war file here. Well, the war file just never ends today. But, well, there's a lot of war going on. From the Associated Press, student and faculty leaders at Columbia University have voted to welcome the military's ROTC program back to campus 40 years after it was banned during the Vietnam War peace movement. Yes, you remember we reported on Harvard just a few weeks ago, and now we're reporting on a Columbia University. Columbia, according to the AP, is the latest in a string of Ivy League schools to consider overtures to ROTC following the repeal of the military's don't ask, don't tell, don't seek, don't smell policy. That's right, it doesn't have anything to do with war and peace. It has to do with promoting the deviant agenda that Columbia University represents so well. And while the ROTC is excited to be opening offices at these Ivy League schools, it's been reported to us that they have not yet found a single young man worthy of admittance into the United States military, with or without the don't ask, don't tell policy. So welcome back, ROTC, to Columbia. I wonder how long it'll be before the ROTC rejects Ivy League schools and just says, you know, maybe we could spend our money better at small community colleges in the Midwest and South, where we might find some real men. All right. Yeah, I don't know where that bumper came from. That was kind of cute. I like that. All right. From the Justice File now. Finally, the war is over. Not really, but it's over for the moment on this show. This is from the Associated Press. In the first case to go to trial since Toyota recalled millions of its vehicles, a federal jury has found that Toyota Motor Corporation is not responsible for a 2005 crash that the driver blamed on a floor mat or the electronic throttle. The jury, listen to this. You all remember the hysteria created around Toyota's lurching out of control and jumping the curb and killing families and all this other hysteria. You remember? Well, the jury deliberated for just 45 minutes and then found that Toyota was not liable. Now, in all this hysteria, Toyota has recalled more than 14 million vehicles globally. Now, that's a lot of cash out of Toyota's pockets. Boy, that's got to be rough. Oh, and on top of that, the company paid the U.S. government a record $48.8 million in fines that were levied against Toyota by the majority shareholder of General Motors, the United States government. U.S. regulators said earlier this month that electronic flaws were not to blame for reports of sudden unintended acceleration in Toyota vehicles. But did anybody hear that report? I don't remember hearing that report. And I pay attention to the news. Maybe it was on page A39 of your local newspaper that nobody reads anymore. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But the accelerating cars flying off bridges, that was top of the news every day, day after day. Anyway. Hey, by the way, I just want to ask your opinion on something. If you watch the videos from Libya, you'll notice that every one of the pickup trucks with a machine gun in the bed is a Toyota. So I don't know if this is a good ad or a bad ad for Toyota that the Libyan ragtag rebels all have Toyotas. But I can tell you this, now that Toyota has been cleared of any impropriety in this this hallucination of sudden acceleration, and we've got daily video of vehicles that are obviously not very well maintained, but still getting the job done in Libya, I think Toyota can look for a bumper quarter this year. For people who are looking for rugged vehicles that can stand the test of time, sand, and bombs.
Hey, my car works.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. My wife is the owner of a Toyota. That's right. So I am biased. But anyways, I just wanted to point out that I was right about Toyota. And for all of you people who thought I wasn't right, I accept your apology. It's okay. All right. More from the Justice File. From Atlanta, as costs to house state inmates have soared in recent years, many conservatives are reconsidering their tough-on-crime approach that has led to stiffer sentences, overcrowded prisons, and bloated correction budgets. That's right, budget deficits, drops in tax revenues, all happening in many states, are forcing the issue, with law and order Republican governors and state legislators beginning to overhaul years of policies that were designed to lock up more criminals and put them away for longer periods of time. That's right, you remember it. The Republicans with their three strikes laws and their mandatory minimum sentences who came in and bamboozled conservatives all over the country and made them think that that was justice. And now we just can't afford it anymore. So suddenly the Republicans show their true colors and show that they'll take the money over the justice every time. That's right. Here's a quote from Adam Gelb, who's director of the Public Safety Performance Project of the Pew Center. Boy, that's a lot of P's.
Yeah.
He says, quote, he says, there's been a dramatic shift in the political landscape on the issue of mandatory minimum sentencing in the last few years. Conservatives have led the charge for more prisons and tougher sentencing, but now they realize they need to be just as tough on criminal justice spending. It's a spending problem. So when the Republicans start realizing that their version of justice costs too much, they're willing to throw their version of justice under the bus. And they're doing it right now. With the GOP in control of more financially strapped state governments, a growing number of Republican elected officials favor a review of the sentencing laws that have contributed to a fourfold increase in prison costs over the past two decades. Did you catch that, folks? That means a 400% increase in the cost of prisons over the last 20 years. It's amazing how the prison industry has grown under Republican administration. It's truly astonishing. So here we have Republicans, and Democrats, frankly, who've been spending money in all kinds of places they shouldn't be spending at all. Schools and health care. Where is that in our founding documents? Where is that in the American experiment that the government was going to pay for schools and for health care and food stamps and prisons, for crying out loud? But what do the Republicans cut first? Prisons. And just so you know, I'm all for that. No mandatory minimums, no three strikes. Get rid of all the prisons. Locking a man up like an animal is not justice, no matter what he's done. Locking him up like an animal is not justice, and it only breeds hatred and contempt And the problem is, when you lock these people up, there's a good chance they're going to get out. Not unlike the Muslim leaders over there in Libya, the one who spent 6 years in Guantanamo. You think he's happy about that now? You think he loves America? Well, do you think these people who spend 5, 10, 15, 20 years in prison, do you think they come out with a better and healthier respect for their fellow man? No, they don't. So Republicans here are considering doing the right thing for the wrong reason, as usual. And while they're at this this idea of cutting the prison budget, I wish that they would look at the budget for schools and health care as well and get out of that business. Let us be free to handle our own affairs, to manage our own affairs between ourselves as citizens. Me and my fellow man, I can figure out how to pay for my own health care. I can figure out how to educate my family, educate my children. And I just don't need the government to be involved. Thank you very much. Please. Do I have another quote here that I want to read? Mark Levin, not the Mark Levin, but not the Mark Levin who created Rush Limbaugh and wrote everything Rush said that was funny for the first 15 years of Rush's career. And you've noticed since Levin left Limbaugh's cadre, Limbaugh's not very funny anymore. But not that Mark Levin. This is a different Mark Levin. From the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. More P's. Lots of P's. Public policy. Anyway, he says, quote, conservatives are about limited government, lower taxes, and personal responsibility. And the reforms that we advocate advance those principles. We're not saying conservatives were among... We're not saying conservatives were wrong 30 years ago with their ideas of three strikes and mandatory minimum sentencing. But the pendulum swung too far. Well, Mr. Levin, whatever your name is there at the public policy, whatever, the pendulum, justice is not a pendulum. It doesn't swing one way or the other. Justice is supposed to be blind and just. And it's you Republicans who swung the pendulum, and it's the bleeding heart liberals who are out there swinging pendulums. When we, the citizens... All we ask for is a fair shake in the justice system and laws we can understand and laws that are in line with the laws laid out by our Creator. That's all we're asking for. Could you try to figure that out? Otherwise, get another job. I mean, go and, open a shoe store. Do something valuable with your life instead of ruining ours with your ideas about justice, government schools, government-funded health care, food stamps, and all the other garbage that you people force us to participate in. Disgusting. All right, one more from the Justice File from Frankfort, Kentucky. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration has taken supplies of a key lethal injection drug from Kentucky and Tennessee, effectively preventing any executions in three states while it investigates how the drug was imported during a national shortage. So this is just an update, folks, on the all-out assault that's taking place against the death penalty. And it's been in the works for decades. And now the leftists are making their final push to eliminate the death penalty. Listen to this. In March, the DEA took Georgia's entire supply of sodium thiopental. And that put a hold on executions there following claims from an attorney for a death row inmate that the state bought the drug from a fly-by-night outfit in the United Kingdom. They improperly imported the drug, and so, well, we've halted all executions there. According to the AP, there are currently no scheduled executions in Kentucky because of a court order that has temporarily halted them. In Tennessee, four inmates are scheduled for execution in September and October of this year, and If you officials in Tennessee can't get your hands on any sodium thiopental, please send me an email. I could give you half a dozen, maybe a dozen more good ideas on how to execute these capital criminals. And it wouldn't require any drugs, frankly. And I'm actually willing to drive down there and help myself. I'll put my money where my mouth is, and I'm actually willing to get my hands dirty, if you know what I mean. All right. Now, from the Politics File, U.S. Senator Scott Brown, oh my goodness, he's lashing out at the Democratic Party because they have some opposition researchers that are investigating Mr. Brown's personal history. Yeah. And he accuses these Democrats of prying into his family's private health insurance records. And he demands that these Democrats stop fighting dirty. Yeah. Yeah, one health insurance provider notified Scott Brown last Tuesday that the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee asked them to provide insurance information on Scott Brown. And he's very upset. He's very upset with the Democrats, is one Scott Brown. He says they're playing dirty. Well, listen to this from the Politics File. This is from the Washington Times. In a blog post Friday morning, Judson Phillips, the outspoken leader of the Tea Party Nation, says that the Massachusetts Tea Party should challenge Scott Brown, and the Tea Party Nation has blasted the freshman lawmaker as a sellout. Yeah. He says, Phillips has also leveled stiff criticism at House Speaker John Boehner, saying that Boehner should take a firmer stand in the spending battles going on in Capitol Hill. And there are rumors also, ladies and gentlemen, that the Democrats are not even going to field a top flight candidate against Scott Brown in 2012 because, hey, why spend a lot of money running against a guy who's pretty much a Democrat? Anyway, all you Tea Partiers out there, I warned you from the get-go about Scott Brown that he is not a conservative. And, I suppose I'm just pointing out the obvious and I should just lay off. Everyone knows that Scott Brown is probably possessed by some sort of alien life form activated by microwave mind control coming out of Hillary Clinton's office. And he's probably had a lot of food dyes for his entire life. He grew up eating Lucky Charms, and it's really not his fault at all. Anyway, all right. We're coming up to the end here. In fact, we've probably gone a little long, but I tend to do that, and I apologize for that, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you can bear with me. But I happened to see an interview on CNN, so I grabbed this story. This is from News Zimbabwe. The controversial boss of the leading U.S. web hosting service, GoDaddy.com, was blasted last Friday for shooting an elephant on a farm in Zimbabwe and then proudly posting the video on his Twitter account. Yeah, he tweeted a picture of him with a high-caliber rifle and a dead elephant. Bob Parsons was already the scourge of many for politically incorrect ads featuring scantily clad models. Count me among that group. And now People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has urged its supporters to blackball GoDaddy until their CEO, Bob Parsons, stops shooting animals. Anyway, it was just interesting to watch on Anderson Cooper's show, to watch this flagrant, flaming homosexual from PETA announce his boycott against this dirtbag pervert at GoDaddy. It was a beautiful thing to watch. Except for the lisp, it kind of made me a little queasy, but get over that. It was worth a watch. All right. Finally, now you're going to hate me for this, but I'm going to say it anyway, because, this is who I am. I'm not such a nice guy. From Phoenix, Arizona, the man who won praise for going to Representative Gabrielle Giffords' aid immediately after she was shot says he has spoken to the injured congresswoman several times on the phone, and he's amazed by her dramatic recovery. You remember Gabrielle Giffords? She's a Democrat politician who actively advocated the murder of certain innocent Americans before she was critically wounded by a gunshot to the head. Well, that's the way that the AP puts it. She was critically wounded by a gunshot to the head. Actually, she was critically wounded by a maniac who shot her in the head. But the Associated Press, all graduates of Columbia University School of Journalism, they don't assign any blame or responsibility to anyone ever, so she was injured by a gunshot. Anyway, you all remember, she was shot in Tucson. 6 people died, 12 others wounded. She has not advocated for the murder of a single innocent unborn child since she was shot in the head. But this, I tell you, these stories of her recovery are getting a little hard to take. Next thing, you know, we'll hear that she's not only written the great American novel from her hospital bed, but she plans to pilot her astronaut's husband's next space shuttle mission because Gabrielle Giffords will be celebrated as America's foremost politician by the deviants and the perverts who are hell-bent on a suicide mission to destroy civilization. I'm out of here for this week. I'll be back with you next week, should the Lord tarry. Until then, I want to thank my friends at KGOV, at American Right to Life, and at Personhood USA. I'll be back with you next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.